Hi everyone, this is Rebecca Weidecker. Welcome to a very special podcast episode, in English this time. This is very unusual and I'm going to explain why in a second. The music that we just listened to is called The Beauty of Maths and it's from someone called Maiden. I found it on a free music website. And I like this piece very much. I enjoy using it in my podcasts because my students like it. I like it as well, and I also like the title. And the beauty of mathematics is very often underestimated. This will also be something I want to go into a bit later. But first of all, let me explain what this is all about. So I'm a maths professor, and usually I do podcasts for my students, and they're usually in German and closely linked to something I'm teaching or to something else that's on the mind of my students. But this time I'm going to do a little podcast episode in English, and it's especially done for my friend and colleague, Ian Antonio Patterson. I was on his show a while ago and I enjoyed it so much. And he asked me about podcast episodes in English, and there was none up until now. Everything was done in German. And I thought about it for a bit and I decided that I want to do one episode in English. I would like to talk about mathematics for a bit. In particular, I would like to talk about research in mathematics, because when I visited him on the show, it was very much about teaching and about inner work and about communication with my students and with my colleagues. This was such a fascinating conversation. I enjoyed it so, so, so much. And I thought it would be a nice compliment to this episode to have a little English podcast episode by myself for everyone who's interested in English about research and mathematics. So Ian, this is for you, especially for you, and I hope you enjoy it, and please feel free to share. Now, what can I say about research and mathematics? First of all, let's talk about mathematics in life in general. Where do we see it, obviously, and where is it present but maybe hidden from our attention usually? So when you go shopping, every time you deal with money, then somehow there's mathematics in the background. Maybe you do some calculations in your head when you go shopping and you compare prices, or when you go on the internet and you look at things. So yes, there's some maths. It's fairly obvious. Maybe also if you watch things on the news, and then there are pieces of information given with percentages, for example, then you might think of mathematics. When you watch the news and you're interested in news from economics, for example, the stock market or something like this, then again, there's mathematics there and it's fairly obvious. Now, with the pandemic, we have all been in touch with a bit more mathematics than usually, because people talked about certain numbers that need to be compared. They talked about risks, they talked about models and computations. So maybe we all start to guess that there is more maths going on than we usually see. The same is true for climate change, for the weather forecast. There is a lot of mathematics going on in the background, as well as computer science and physics, for example. So let's dive into this a little bit. If you look around, then there are lots of places where mathematics will go on in the background, and it will be part of, for example, modeling something. For example, in the stock market, when people try to explain the movements, or when they try to project into the future how the economy is going to develop or how certain stocks are going to develop, then there's mathematics in the background describing what is going on. And then the models not only try to explain what has been going on in the past and what happens now, but often they also try to predict. So they try to predict, oh, with this and this changing, this stock will go up. With this and this changing, the economy will probably develop like this. And then there will be news and someone will explain why people think the economy will be in better shape next year or maybe in worse shape. So all this is based on some kind of mathematical modeling. Very often it will also be based on simulations on the computer. And this is another aspect of modern mathematical research. A lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is closely linked to working with a computer, working with models, with simulations, with approximations, with programming, writing code, testing things. So there's a close link, and that's also pretty exciting, I think. So it's a slightly different level of mathematical research that is possible now that we have very powerful computers. When you see the weather forecast, then what you see is an application of dynamics of, well, mostly air masses, not only, but there's a lot of air masses dynamics going on. That's physics. To describe it, again, you need the language of mathematics, and it's fairly complex. This is a really, really difficult and complex topic. And then in order to do all the calculations, you don't only need models, you also need powerful computers. So first, you need to understand what is going on in the physics. Then you need to understand the mathematics that you need to describe this. This goes hand in hand. And once you have the models and a lot of data that you have collected, then all this needs to be fed into computer programs. Those programs have to be written before. So you need people who are good coders, who can write programs in order to feed this information into a computer so that then the computer can do calculations and can, for example, give you a forecast for the next few hours or maybe for the next 2 or 3 days. The forecasts have become much more precise recently, much better than they have been 10, 20, 30 years ago, which has to do with better models, but also with better and faster computers and better programs. So there are lots of skills that go hand in hand here. It's the skills in the meteorology department, the physics department, people who understand what goes on in the physics that happens. Then you need people who are able to explain this mathematically, to maybe come up with better models, who are also able to explain the mathematics that is going on. Then you need people who understand this and can, for example, write computer programs, or who can maybe work towards better data that you can collect in order to feed information into the programs. And then finally, you need an interpretation of the data that you get and of the output of the computer programs. So there's a lot of expertise and it's fairly mixed. So hopefully people with a very good core expertise in one of these subjects work together and communicate well, so that in the end, you have information that can be communicated to the public that has not the knowledge, at least usually does not have the knowledge about everything that is going on in the background. It becomes even harder when you try to not just to model the weather for the next few days, but climate. So in the long term, it gets even more complex because the models are more complex and it's harder to predict how a long-term change will affect other bits of the model. And sometimes there will be so-called tipping points where if a particular aspect of the model is changed dramatically enough, then it will influence other things in a way that is not easily returned, or maybe that's impossible to be returned to its previous state. Again, it's mathematics that is going on there. And this is why, again, you need experts from different fields to work together closely and to communicate well, so that you can come up with models that are mathematically useful and make sense, and that also capture as much as possible from the information that you have. With the pandemic, we have seen how difficult it is to communicate. So in research, it very much depends on the kind of research that you do. If you do purely theoretical research, then you have your theoretical results. And if an argument is correct, then it is correct and it stands. And then you can discuss whether you like it or not, or you can say, oh, this is not very interesting, or it's very interesting. But the correctness, once established, stays. Whereas there are other bits of research where, for example, you correct something that someone thought before based on some data, based on some interpretation, and then you find evidence that goes against this interpretation, so you correct a previous statement. And this doesn't mean that the scientists before had no idea what they were doing. No, based on the facts that they had an interpretation, And then later, with new facts, another interpretation was possible and maybe became more likely to be true. But there are parts of research, or there are areas in research, where you cannot just theoretically prove something and then you know it's true, but instead you collect evidence. And then you have a theory and you try and collect evidence that either supports this theory, so you work with it further, or you collect evidence that goes against this theory, and then you discard it and you come up with something new and better. And a lot of discussion has happened, for example, when it comes to the pandemic and how we should react to it. And some of this discussion was typical for what happens in actual research. You have models, you have data, and then you have an interpretation, and people have different opinions on what this interpretation should be and what you should do in the future. But that doesn't necessarily mean that one person is a better scientist than someone else. It's just different backgrounds, different experiences. And then you have to decide by listening closely what interpretation you find more convincing. And the problem is that if you don't know a lot about the background, then sometimes a person can be more convincing, not because the argument is better, but just because the person is, for example, a better communicator, is just more convincing as a person, maybe more charismatic. That's a danger when we talk about science where we don't know everything about the background, where we don't have all the facts. This can happen in many sciences. It can also happen in some parts of mathematics. And in the past, we have seen a lot of this in the open discussions that came with the pandemic. Now, to finish off, I would like to talk a little bit about the research that I do. My research is in an area of mathematics that is called algebra. More precisely, it's an area that is called group theory. And a group is just a mathematical way to model symmetry. So I'm interested in phenomena where symmetry or regularity play a role, and where this is used mathematically in order to explain something, maybe simplify something, maybe find a better model, maybe make calculations easier, or just to plainly understand what's going on. And let me give you an example that is quite timely. When you see all these virus models now on the news, then they are sort of spheric, and then they have this irregular structure on the outside. But if you look closely enough, it's not quite so irregular. These spikes that come out, they are distributed on the surface in quite a regular pattern. And why is that? So many decades ago, we didn't know that viruses, or at least many viruses, look like this, but people thought they looked like this. And then later there was more and more evidence to support this. And where does this idea come from? Viruses could have any shape. We know that they are small, we know their functionality, but why should they be spherical most of the time? The reason is symmetry. Viruses contain information about their structure, and with this information, once they enter a host, they make the host replicate the virus. So in order for this to be possible, the virus has to be small, because it has to enter the host and enter the cells and then make the cell reproduce the virus. But the information has to be detailed enough so that the virus can be replicated correctly. And when we hear things in the news about mutants, then this is because in the replication process, little mistakes happen. This is normal. This happens with viruses all the time. But as you see now, there is a conflict. On the one hand, you have all this complex information about the viral structure, and it should be reproduced correctly as far as possible. So where is this information stored? It has to be stored on a very tiny, on very little space, because the virus itself needs to be tiny in order to be able to enter the host and not to be detected by the immune system and so on. So how do we solve this conflict? We use symmetry. If the virus has a very regular shape, a very symmetric shape, then it's easier to contain the information about its structure. Because then you can basically say, this is the building block of the virus, it's very simple, blah blah blah, this is how it goes. And now apply the following symmetry and build several blocks of this shape and put them together in something that looks like a sphere. So this, just as a construction, manual, maybe almost. It's like an instruction how you should replicate the virus, and this is much easier than having to give lots of details about lots of individual pieces of the virus that all look different. If a virus was very irregular, then it would be much harder to communicate with little space the information for reproduction. The more regular it is, the easier it is to communicate information about the reproduction. So this is how in the, I think, 1950s, 60s, the first people came up with virus models that used symmetry and that came up with this more or less spherical shape where you have a regular pattern on the surface. All this has to do with having information stored in a tiny place. There are other instances where you see this. If you want to memorize something, then it's much easier to memorize something with a lot of repetition and regularity than memorizing something that is very irregular and very non-repetitive, lots of different words, complicated phrases. Just compare memorizing a random page from a random book to memorizing lyrics from a song with very repetitive patterns and rhyming that makes it much, much, much easier to remember the words. A chorus that repeats. My favorite example is Fly Robin Fly. I think that's from the 70s. It's so repetitive. And of course, once you've heard it, you can never get the words out of your mind again. And there are so many examples for things that are much more complicated to remember. And I'm sure many of you know examples of this kind. So regularity and repetitiveness makes it easier to remember something. It makes it easier to communicate something. And it also makes communication less prone to mistakes. Because if you communicate something with a lot of repetition, then if there is a mistake in the communication, it can be spotted easier and earlier because of the regularity. Whereas if everything is very irregular to start with, then it's harder to detect such a mistake. This has applications, for example, when you code something, when you encrypt something. Encryption is another area where mathematics plays a huge role in the background. For example, large prime numbers play a role there, and this is also not commonly known. There are so many more examples. I could talk for, I think, another hour about this, but I won't. I hope that I sparked your curiosity a little bit. I hope that I was able to convey that there is a lot of mathematics going on in the background in all our lives, and very often we are not aware of it. It explains a lot. It gives a lot of orientation, information in our lives every day. And there are some specific areas where, in particular, symmetry plays a role. I'm excited about some new research projects that I will have where we have self-organizing structures, for example, crystals, and we try to understand how symmetry plays a role there in their self-organization because it influences the properties of the materials that emerge. This is very exciting. Some of my work is much more theoretical. And again, mathematics is, I think I know, I commented on this in the podcast with Ian, mathematics is a very inclusive community. We are very diverse, very different, and you can also see this in the research projects. Some projects are very secluded, very tiny, very, very highly specialized, and then there is maybe one person working there, maybe two or three, and they know each other and they exchange information and everyone else thinks, what's going on there? I have no idea what they're talking about. It might be highly relevant. It might be just something in the corner and they find it fascinating. And then there are other projects where lots of people, maybe tens or hundreds of people around the world are working on this in large teams. This is also possible. Mathematics leaves room for all these different types of research topics and also research styles. Some of us like to be alone and just think and write something down and think again. And others really like to be in a group and discuss all the time. Mathematical research leaves room for these different types. And the same is true for people who learn about mathematics, higher mathematics. It's possible to go through your undergrad almost by yourself. It's also possible to learn in a group most of the time, to have lots of discussions. It's all fun, it's all useful, it's all maths. And in particular, when you combine mathematical skill with very good coding skills or very good communication skills or both, then you have a really exciting set of skills for various fascinating challenges to tackle. I think that very often it's communication skills together with expertise somewhere else that makes you valuable for society and that makes you a person who can solve and communicate problems and solutions. That's it. And now let's listen to the beauty of maths once more. Just a second while I start the music. Oh, I'm afraid this will be a little moment now. There it is. There's the music again. Sorry for this. This was fun. Ian, I hope you enjoyed this. This was for you. And I hope everyone else who listens to this enjoys it as well. Okay, that's it. Talk to you soon.